Congress may be on recess, but there's still an awful lot happening that we need to chat about. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, great to be back with you, Barry, again here in the studio. We're recording late in the week again, just because, you know, we have found ourselves, when we record like on Wednesday, a lot of stuff happens on Thursday and Friday. Well, it's been a little quieter recently, but there's always stuff happening that we're happy to get into our show and talk about from a biblical worldview perspective. Sometimes people get lost in the fact that we do talk politics a lot, and there is a, you're not talking about the biblical worldview aspect. I'm like, it's all inculcated into what we say. Hopefully we're analyzing all this stuff from a biblical worldview. Does the Bible speak to politics? Sure it does. Is that our primary function? No, it's not. Our primary function as Christians is to, bring people into the kingdom. But there's also an aspect of once you've got them in the kingdom, they need to be able to think, independently and logically, because after all, God is the inventor of logic. It really was not, Aristotle, as I love it when people say Aristotle invented logic. No, he didn't. He just merely uncovered the laws, began the long process of uncovering the laws of logic, and that's God's invention, and that's how God talks to us. Yes, if this is kind of an obscure reference, but there was a an internal battle in Christianity in philosophers between a guy named Van Til and a guy named Clark. Well, Clark always talked about, I'm a Van Tilian as far as I understand it, but Clark always talked about a thing I'm trying to remember which gospel. I think it's Mark. In the beginning was the Word. And in the beginning was Clark always said that the words could be translated in the beginning with logic.
Logos, yeah.
Yeah, the logos.
Word and logos, yes.
Yeah.
I understand where they take the Greek and do that.
Yes. Yeah, and which means, and of course, the Word was Christ. You know, Christ is the Lord of logic.
And actually,
you know, yeah.
As you were saying that, it occurred to me. You said Mark. It's not Mark. That's John 1.
It is John 1. Duh.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was.
Sometimes on the fly, I can't remember which gospel says what. It does happen, folks. Sorry. Yeah. No.
That means that you're telling me that you weren't a finalist in Bible memory?
No, and you know what? My daughter did Bible quizzing when we were in the Nazarene church, so I'm a little ashamed. So, but it's interesting. Some of my daughters were involved in Bible quizzing and did very well, which means, you know, they knew several books in and out. Those questions were tough. I can remember sitting in some of those meets and going, wow, that's a tough question.
No doubt.
So.
Yeah, I know some of I've met some people who actually put those on, and they do. They dig into some really pretty deep theological waters to, you know, for people to remember where things are and why.
Yeah, but that being said, you know, we had a program a couple weeks ago about things are bizarre out there, and there's a reason why. It was what we titled it. And there is a reason why. It's because we are abandoning any kind of attempt at rational thought. As we get more and more and more, as the world becomes more and more and more bizarre, you can go back and look, and it's less and less and less logical. Do I mean that logic rules the day and love never wins out and blah, blah, blah? No, that's not what I mean. But we have to think rationally about the things that we do and the way we analyze what is happening in the world Because God demands it. God does not demand that we, that when we come to a state of belief, that we suddenly drop all rational thought, as our atheist and agnostic adversaries would tell you. That's absurd. In fact, very often we can directly use logic and the presuppositional arguments and the evidence that is given to us by God to defeat those who would argue that he does not exist. And if you pay close enough attention to those arguments, then you can get there. And if you, you know, not everybody is designed or has the desire or feels led to talk about apologetics from that particular aspect. And I understand that. But there are those of us who are kind of called to that. I'm sort of an intermediate in presuppositional apologetics and argumentation. Basically, presuppositional is you assume God, and you don't surrender that to your opponents, the supposed neutral ground, because as Van Til, who we mentioned earlier, stated, there is no such thing as neutrality.
No, there is no such thing as a brute fact, is what Van Til would say. That you cannot have a fact that's separate from the underlying presupposition that God is, God exists, and he is the author of all truth, and he sets the rules, and so therefore there's nothing that has its own independent definitional state outside of God. It's not possible to do so.
And interestingly, you know, Greg Bahnsen, another presuppositionalist, the guy who basically made Van Til available to people who did not have PhDs. That's what I would say about Greg Bahnsen. Basically used the laws of logic to prove the existence of God. Made that it was never clearer than in a debate between he and a guy named Gordon Stein, who was head of the joke that comes to mind is the He-Man Woman Haters Club. He was essentially the Atheists of America or something along that line.
Barry Lynn?
No, Gordon Stein.
Well, Gordon Stein. Oh, yeah, Gordon Stein was with the American Atheist. Yes.
American Atheist, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're okay. I'm sorry. I was doing a little pre-scanning here and just lost track.
Yeah, well, that happens. I've done it too. This is what happens when we're not in the same studio, folks. Not giving each other the hand signals and that kind of thing. Maybe we ought to turn the cameras on. The only problem is if we turn the cameras on, we won't have enough bandwidth to actually get the voice across. So,
that could be a problem.
Yeah, that could be
again,
a real problem.
That actually might be something that some of our listeners might find actually refreshing.
Yes. But basically, Bahnsen used the laws of logic to essentially show that there was such a thing as transcendence. Stein tried to make the argument basically that logic was a set of rules agreed upon, and Bahnsen showed that made absolutely no sense, and that you know, what did people do before the laws of logic were agreed upon? And when the answer is they operated on the logic, the law, and the logic that was written on their hearts. So logic is a creation of God. It is a transcendent thing. We talk about, in fact, one of the drop dead replies, it came in a question and answer where a lot of the heavy lifting in debate often comes about is in the question and answer period, where the two debaters question and answer one another. Basically, Stein asked Bahnsen. They'd had a big long discussion about the laws of logic and the only way you could tell something existed was if you could taste, smell, touch, feel, sense it in some way. And Stein made the mistake of asking Bahnsen to name one thing which couldn't be felt, seen, touched, heard, smelled, tasted, blah, blah, blah. And Bahnsen said, well, the laws of logic. And Stein fell apart after that. There really was nothing left to say. I mean, Bonson had proved that they were transcendent. What does transcendence mean? You know, that's a term that gets thrown around in church a lot. Transcendence means that something is both very near and very far away. In other words, it sort of exists all around you on another plane. A plane that you cannot necessarily have direct contact with, but you have insight to. So that's in the sense that God is transcendent. He is both here and far away. He's here surrounding us all the time. And yet we cannot see him, smell him, touch him, taste him, feel him, hear him. We hear him in the still small voice, if you will. We hear him through the ministrations of the Holy Spirit. We hear him through the ministrations of his word as interpreted through the ministrations of the Holy Spirit. And yet he is here right next to us all the time.
Well, it's a very good thing that God is there with us, because I'd shudder to think about just exactly how difficult things would be if God wasn't superintending. You know, if he wasn't constantly intervening in the affairs of man, which he does. You know, we don't believe in a the what they call the blind watchmaker version of God, or the deistic version of God, where he created everything and wound it up like a watch and then set it off and sets back and watches to see what happens, because even he doesn't have an idea of what these little creatures that he created are going to do. But he does. He knows that full well. We're known from before we were formed in the womb, we're known by God. And of course, being such, we're also born into sin and, into the sin of our first father, Adam. And so therefore, without that superintending presence, without God being there walking with us and guiding us, we would run off into some really strange areas. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't strange areas that are run off into already, and that's kind of what we're looking at today, because there are some really interesting things going on, Chuck. First and foremost, the biggest news, at least in my part of the state, is that on Thursday night, the President of the United States was in the area. President Trump decided to hold a rally in Huntington, West Virginia. Why Huntington, West Virginia? Well, because Trump's not stupid. Trump won West Virginia by 41 percentage points over Hillary Clinton. West Virginia, since 2010, has done a complete flip over to where the Republican Party now controls the House of Representatives, or their House of Delegates, and their state Senate are both in Republican control. Their only problem has been that, because historically West Virginia has been a Democratic Union stronghold,
right,
with the coal industry and others, that it's been next to impossible to have a governor who's a Republican. Now, I know back in the 70s, Archmore was governor for a little while, but basically since then, I mean, Gaston Caperton, Joe Manchin, Earl Ray Tomlin, and now Jim Justice, who just happens to be the only billionaire living in West Virginia, is now the governor. And, of course, we talked a little bit before about a couple things that were going on with their budget crises that they were having in special sessions that had to be called, and the governor basically, forcing the legislature to come back because he didn't accept their first budget. Well, last night, when the president came to Huntington, they made an interesting announcement. And that announcement is that Democratic Governor Jim Justice, who was just elected in 2016, this is his first year, he actually... Interesting guy. He was a Republican before he switched to the Democratic Party back in 2015 in order to line up to run for governor because, well...
Yeah, you can't get elected.
Historically, the odds are you can't win as governor in West Virginia as a Republican. So he switched to the Democratic Party and won, fairly handily. And last night, he announced that because of the president, and because of what he sees as his agenda being in line with where he thinks West Virginia needs to go, he's switching back to the Republican Party. West Virginia will now have a one-party executive and legislature for the first time, and I don't even know if it's ever happened before, Chuck. If it did, it's happened. It happened like somewhere between 1863 and 1890.
Yeah,
1863 being when West Virginia came into
the Union. Yeah,
yeah, where West Virginia actually was carved off of Virginia and became their own state. So, yeah, it's rare that it's ever happened. But as of this morning, and I don't know what the process is. He probably has to file some paperwork and things. But West Virginia now has a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. Now, if they think that things are going to change and they're going to get more done, I don't know, because, well, you know, did Justice have a major shift in his philosophy and his thinking, or is he just reading tea leaves? You know, is he seeing that the trend line is swinging, that West Virginia has gotten tired of decades and decades of being basically one of the poorest states in the Union because of the failure of socialistic politics, and are trying to move in a different direction. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you vote Republican that you end the
right.
socialistic politics.
Oh,
you just
gosh,
get
no.
The Republican flavor of socialistic politics, it seems. So we'll see what's going to happen with that, Chuck. But it is actually creating quite a bit of, and I don't think it's so much a stir, because most people in and around West Virginia politics kind of figured this was going to happen sooner or later anyway. But Justice, who basically owns dozens of companies, mainly around the coal industry, has decided that it's time to line up West Virginia's priorities with the president's agenda. And in order to do that, he can't be in a party that's basically trying to delegitimize the presidency of Donald Trump. I think it's probably a fairly good strategic move on his part. I mean, he'll take a little heat for a while, but honestly, he did it over the summer. So the West Virginia legislature won't be coming back in until January of next year anyway. So
yeah.
I don't think he's going to have too much to worry about.
They have a true part-time legislature, unlike us, who supposedly has one that really kind of isn't.
Yeah, they meet for 60 days. I mean, and it's an actual 60 calendar days. They meet, you know, 7 days a week. They come in February, and they're done by, like, the end of April. It's amazing. We've got some friends who took our Institute on the Constitution course, who then ran for the West Virginia legislature and won as part of that swing over going from 2010 forward. One of whom is still there as a committee chairman now, and they're there. I mean, when they head to Charleston, they're going to be there for the duration.
That's yeah.
a 60-day legislative window, and they do everything in that 60 days. That's their transportation. That's their operating budgets. That's all of the priority issues. That's all the things that people want them to do. I mean, they probably spend all year collecting little slips of paper and emails and letters from constituents, and then figure out, okay, let's see what we can do to see if we can get this introduced and passed during our legislative session.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Unlike Ohio, which basically has, we call ourselves a part-time legislature, but let's not kid ourselves, our legislature meets all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think you're right there on the border, and you do have people inside the system. So you hear more than we do, because you're not that far from Charleston, and I'm sure you can get the radio and all that kind of stuff from down there. And also, you're not too far from Huntington. Is it more efficient to require your legislature to get all its work done in that small window?
I believe it is, because even though there's, you know, and of course, it's not like everything shuts down after the 60th day and nobody talks about it or does anything legislatively until
right.
the following January or February. But, you know, I think what you do is that it really, you have to focus in and really understand what you're going to try to accomplish as a member and as a caucus, especially a majority caucus with the Republicans. You know, because you can't come, they don't like coming back. I mean, this cycle was different because the governor refused to sign the budget, and then they basically were forced to come back in a special session in order to try to pass a budget before they, you know, they ran out of money in West Virginia.
Right.
Well, ran out of money to pay government programs, that is.
Yeah, the bottom line.
They were going to run out of money because they still have taxpayers in West Virginia, even though it doesn't seem like it.
Right.
They still have the taxpayers. So I think it's much better to do it in a short window, because instead of these guys becoming pretty much career legislators, they really do have to stay basically back home on the farm, if you want to say it, or back home in their districts, working their regular jobs, and, you know, they're trying to keep their businesses afloat, et cetera, you know, their law practices, their medical practice, whatever it might be, from wherever they come from. They still do a lot of politicking all year long, just like anybody else, but they don't basically, they're not going in every week for months and months and months and months and months, so that special interest lobbies can sit there and bend their ear and convince them to do a bunch of stuff. And, you know, they have to bend their ear and then hope that when they gets down to it, they've got they're part of that 60-day window.
Well,
it's almost like when we do a budget in Ohio.
Uh-huh.
You know, that budget cycle is about 4 months long from the time the governor drops his executive budget to the time he signs the final budget. And, you know, there's some pressure, and a lot of things can end up getting a little crazy, and sometimes you can get good stuff happening, and sometimes bad things happen. But it keeps everybody on their toes, and usually what happens is people are so on their toes about the budget that if somebody tries to introduce something, let's say, strange, like they did, you know, there was going to be a situation where they were calling for mandatory vaccinations.
Yeah.
For workers in education. Well, that got floated in a Senate hearing, and boy, did it get shut down in a heartbeat at the next hearing. Is about 30 some. We talked about this. Over 30 some people came in to testify against that piece. I mean, it was pretty impressive. So you know, you have that, and of course, that means that people are paying attention. But if you spread it out over a longer period, that's when things, you know, that's when they can sit there behind the scenes and figure out, well, let's move this bill, but let's at the end attach this piece to it, because we can't get this piece out because there's too much uproar over the bill as it stands, but let's wrap it into something else. Now, yeah. I have to admit, as a lobbyist, I've used that tactic, and I used it pretty effectively last year to get in something that I knew would probably get a lot of flack if we just came out there and introduced it as a standalone bill. And that was the provision to create a felony penalty for anyone assisting somebody in taking their own life, assisted suicide. We've now, instead of it basically being injunctive relief, you have to run to a court and say, I think that somebody's going to, his doctor or this person is going to give this person a lethal dose of something, and then you have to do all the proving. Basically, if something happens like that, it's not injunctive relief. It's this person is going to prison for 1 to 5 years. Now, it's big in the pro-life community that happened, but it probably wouldn't have happened had we just introduced a standalone bill, because of the medical community and all of these, you know, various hospice and palliative care folks would have probably come out and wring their hands about, oh, you're treating us like we'd be criminals and da-da-da-da-da, and things happen and, you know, all the excuses you hear. But we just quietly got it done. We slipped it into another bill at the very last minute, and that was it. That
voila.
Does happen.
Yeah.
But I think the 60-day window, you really have to have all your ducks in a row before that gavel drops on the opening of that 60 days, because there isn't a whole lot that's going to get developed and get through the process in 60 calendar days. Now, when we say 60 days in the Ohio legislature, well, they meet Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and sometimes on Thursdays. So you figure that out, how many actual weeks that is. If it's 60 days, you're looking at 30-plus weeks.
20,
that's over,
yeah,
6 months.
20, 30 weeks, sessions. Yeah, somewhere in that vicinity. 25 weeks, probably.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, and it may be longer, because there are some weeks when they take a two-week break around,
right,
Easter, and, you know, they take this break here and that break there. Yeah, you're looking at 6 to 8 months.
Yeah. Yep.
That you have to play around to try to get things in play. And that's just as part of a cycle. You know, we have a 2-year legislature, and of course they go through July, obviously, with the budget on the first year. They're now on a little bit of a break, although the Joint Agriculture Committee met in a show committee hearing at the Ohio State Fair this week, just, you know, I guess it was so that the legislatures could get into the fair free, I think. I don't know. but anyhow, of course, you would think the Ag Committee, which basically has the oversight of the state, it has oversight over the Department of Agriculture, which has oversight over the state fairgrounds, what would have been the thing that that joint committee would have been talking about? Ride safety, right? Because we had, on the opening night of the Ohio State Fair, a ride malfunctioned, broke, threw a man to his death, and put four others in critical condition in the hospital, which they're still there in critical condition.
Yeah.
I just saw an update yesterday.
Four of them still in, yeah. Well, okay.
That was the one item that nobody talked about during. They had a moment of prayer at the beginning, said something about how sad it was for the person who died and the people who were injured, and then didn't. Nothing was said about it from that point forward.
Well, okay, let me ask you a question. Do you know who is responsible for ride inspections in this state?
Department of Commerce, I believe.
No. Agriculture.
Ag. Okay, that's right.
I just watched a video on YouTube, and for some reason, folks, don't ask me why. I've kind of gotten into watching videos recently. They're short and they're interesting, on defunct rides at amusement parks.
Oh yes.
Okay, defunct rides brought back memories from some stuff, like, for instance, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea at Disney World. I always loved that ride. I don't know why. It was a dumb little ride. I mean, you knew you weren't really taking a submarine under the earth, but it was an interesting ride. Anyway, one of the rides they talked about was Son of Beast at King's Island. And if you'll notice,
I remember that one.
Son of Beast is defunct. It is one of those defunct rides. Well, one of the problems they had, it had major safety concerns. If you remember, it was mostly a wooden roller coaster, but it did have a steel loop-de-loop. Well, right. What happened was people started saying, there were issues. And the Department of Agriculture came in and to quote unquote inspect the ride, and people would say, "Well, is it safe?" And the Department of Agriculture said, "It looks okay to us. We're not ride engineers." Well, folks, the Department of Agriculture really—I'm sure they have people who know something about the issue, but they're not experts on it. So. You've got a combination of things that went into that mess at Ohio State, at the Ohio State Fair. One, you have carnival companies who bring rides in who are desperate to compete with places like Cedar Point and Kings Island and other amusement parks that are all bragging about they have the highest, fastest, scariest roller coaster. You have roller coasters where you sit on a bicycle seat and they strap you up and you do loop-de-loops and turn curves. People are demanding more and more and more and more and more and more thrill rides. Well, in order to compete with that, they've bought these units that do something a little more scary, right? Well, the problem is, how well are they being maintained? Right. Because I'm guessing that carnival companies are operating on an extremely thin margin, because
you're right, and you just made the difference. You know, you're talking about these amusement parks that have basically what we call static rides. Those are ones that are built in the park and they stay there. But
exactly.
When you're talking about fairs and like the state fair, you're talking about carny companies who pack and unpack these things. You know, they pack them up on a big truck. They drive them from one fair to the other.
Exactly.
Then they slap them together, and again, I'm sure that they try. But when you start hearing some of the stories about, you know, people in the community when the carnival comes to town, and how the carny workers come in and they load up on alcohol and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, first thing in the morning, and then they're out there supposedly taking 8 hours to put up a ride and secure it, and they get done in four, you start to wonder a little bit.
Well, if you go out and look, my kids, we would never let them ride the rides at the carnival. I mean, the simple stuff, merry-go-rounds and that kind of stuff. But they always wanted to do, like, stuff that went way up and twirled around and stuff. And I'm like, 0% chance you're getting on that thing. And that, you know, they were little and they'd wonder why. And I'd take them back behind and show them how stuff was propped up on like 6 2-by-6 blocks to level it out. And I'm like, that's why. It's not buried in the ground. Exactly. You're not getting on it. And my daughter came to me the other day. My almost 22-year-old daughter came to me the other day and she goes, Mom, thank you so much for not letting us ride those rides at the fair.
Yeah.
She was very grateful because of what happened to this poor guy who was killed and the other four people who are injured because what apparently happened was a weld snapped or a bolt snapped or something snapped and the car came off. Well, would an inspection necessarily have caught that? It depends on if there were cracks in the metal and that kind of thing or how many hours they had on the bolt that held it all together. You know, they may not know. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that a ride engineer is supposed to know. Unfortunately, how often, you know, do you actually get a ride engineer to come out and look at that stuff? Now, places like Disney World and Six Flags, those kinds of things, they have people that go around Kings Island. They have people that go around and inspect those rides regularly. Well, that's part of the problem with the old Son of Beast. So that system broke down a little bit. They hired a company to build the ride, and then they didn't like the way they were building the ride. Somebody in corporate didn't like the way they were building the ride and the amount of time it was taking and the amount of cost overruns there were, and they fired the company and finished it with internal staff. Well, that's probably always a mistake. If you've hired an outside consultant to build something, let the outside consultant build it. Don't take over when you weren't involved in the design considerations. It's a dumb plan. You know, Kentucky tried to solve this problem with the pack up and move rides. Do you know what they did?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, the Kentucky State Fair is about an inch and a half from my sister's house, so we could see the rides. The permanent standing rides there. Well, they had Six Flags come in and build the rides, and it's part of the Kentucky State Fairgrounds. Now, it turned into...
Oh, yeah, it's called Kentucky Kingdom, isn't it?
Well, it used to be called Kentucky Kingdom when Six Flags still operated it. That's the problem.
Yeah, when Six Flags was still actually a going concern.
Yeah, there was kind of a lease agreement. They had the land and that kind of thing. And when Six Flags pulled out of there due to economic pressures, there was a big fight about who ended up owning the rides. This was a big deal. Who owns the ride? Kentucky State Fair Authority said they owned it, and Six Flags said they owned it, and there was a huge and Six Flags was moving stuff out, and they got a court order to make them stop moving roller coasters and things out. So, you know, that's one of the risks that you take. Now, you know, you go back to the idea that in the old days, for instance, there were more amusement parks. Buckeye Lake had one. Believe it or not, Columbus had three of them. Three amusement parks. I can tell you where there was one called Olentangy. There was one called, Minerva Park. Which is now a city in North Columbus. It actually is a little town, Minerva Park. And if you go in there, you can see remnants of the old amusement park. And there was one called it was over off Indianola. Olentangy Park. I can't remember the third one, but
Iuka Park.
What was it?
Iuka Park?
Nope.
Okay, because I was going to say there's a whole area that's like really, you know, you get over in that area on...
Oh, it was called... It was Indianola.
West of campus.
Indianola.
Indianola
Park. Well, Indianola Park. You were not far from on Olentangy. Olentangy was off High Street in Clintonville. okay. is where that park was. The other park was over off Indianola Avenue. They were all connected to interurban car lines. And the reason that they did that was they had excess electricity and they needed turnaround points. So at those turnaround points, they'd run special cars to go up to the amusement park. Well, Columbus can't handle three amusement parks. Now, amusement parks then weren't like they are now. I mean, you went and you had a roller coaster and you had a flume ride and you know, you had rides, but it wasn't fancy. It was those of us who were old enough to remember Buckeye Lake Park, they were like that. Those of us who aren't old enough to remember that, I feel sorry for you, but those kind of things were fun, but they didn't have the big giant thrill rides. You had rides that, you know, had a little bit of thrill thing, you know, these cars that were way up above the on chains that were way up above the park, and it spun around, that kind of thing. Okay, well, this is what you run into with these kinds of things. People want more and more and more and more, and you can't give it to them in a situation where you're dragging these rides around on a truck. It just can't happen. You see these little carnivals set up with a Ferris wheel in a shopping center parking lot. Well, most of those are pretty minor league. I mean, Tilt-A-Whirls and maybe a Ferris wheel. And if you go out and look to anchor them down, and this kind of drives owners of these places a little nuts. They anchor them down by running rebar into the asphalt, which is a good thing. Having a Ferris wheel tip over is not my idea of fun.
I wouldn't think so.
No, I don't even go up in those things. I don't care for it because I always get with some idiot who wants to rock the cart. I'm have a heights thing, and you get me into the top and then want to rock the cart, you're likely to get punched. I mean, that's the bottom line. Because rationality loses out and fear takes over, and I'll do anything I need to do to keep myself from being scared to death. So, but that being said, what should the Ohio State Fair do? I don't know. Inspect more closely. How long were they shut down? 3 days? You know they went over those rides with a fine-tooth comb after a fatal accident.
Yeah, I'm sure they had to. And as far as I understand, I think all the rides are back open now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder how much maintenance was done during those two or three down days.
I would say probably quite a bit. So
that had been deferred.
It's interesting, but it's sad that it has to lead to loss of life in order to get to that point.
Well, that's kind of human nature, is it not?
It is.
Very often, how many of us don't fix the barn door until the horse is out? I'll plead guilty. It's happened to me many, many times. It's like, why didn't I fix that?
Yeah, I understand that.
Going back to the biblical worldview, God warns us against that kind of complacency. How many places in the Old Testament are we warned to make sure that we properly maintain things, keep things in working order, make sure we don't cheat people by having things that aren't working properly, dishonest weights and measures and that kind of thing. Those are those wider implications of those laws. Some people want to look at those narrowly, and no, those widen out into all kinds of things. There is a principle. There is a letter of the law and the spirit of the law. That's why you can't ignore Old Testament law, because there is a spirit of the law. And while some of those things, things about, your camels and that kind of thing, it crosses over into other things. It widens out, and the same principles apply. I think the Apostle Paul made that clear when he talked about don't keep the ox, don't cheat the ox out of his, his meal while he's tramping out the grain.
Yeah, don't muzzle the ox that tramps out the grain.
Yeah, exactly. that's a principle. That is a spirit of the law rather than letter of the law principle, because what he was talking about was don't cheat preachers. Don't fail to feed your pastor was essentially what that what he the point he was making with in that particular letter. Mm-hmm. So, again, these things have much wider implication. As we've you know, they also have those narrow implications, and we don't know for sure whether it wasn't a design flaw. In the unit itself, and the Carnival had really, it wasn't their problem. It was the company that built the ride in the first place. We don't know that. And believe me, we'll find out when the lawsuits hit, because you and I both know there's going to be a big payout for this.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
In fact, I said this could, it could. The honestly, the state fair is rapidly becoming an anachronism. This could be a thing that could lead eventually to the demise of things like the Ohio State Fair.
Well, that's a possibility. I want to segue here just a little bit. Because
we need to do that.
And, you know, I know it's a horrible way to segue here, but, you know, you talked about the paydays. Well, that's what we need to talk about now, and that's payday, because in Ohio, it's now August, which means that it was time for all these politicians to file their campaign finance reporting. It's for the last cycle, the last quarter, and to show how much money they've raised, how much they now have on hand for each of their races. And it's very instructive, Chuck, and I love it because our friends over at Third Rail Politics has a great article out there just called Campaign Finance Reports that was put out this week. And it was, on July 31st was when they were due. And so the next day they had this all broken down and have it broken down by who gave what to who and everybody. So, you know, if you really want to get into this minutia, you could. But the overarching theme is that this reporting period is so big for all of these candidates because what they want to do is come out with a big presser the next day talking about how they're in the lead of the race or how, you know, they've garnered the most support or they've got the biggest number of individual donations or whatever it might be in order to spin it in the best possible light for themselves. But here's, you know, since we're going into 2018 and we've got we got major ballot decisions to make, we're going to be picking people to nominate to run for all five of the statewide seats, governor, the secretary of state, the auditor, the treasurer, and the attorney general. We've got House and Senate elections, and we also will have you know, some other, like we have a U.S. Senate race between, well, I would say Sherrod Brown on the left because he has no opposition, and Josh Mandel or Mike Gibbons, who are both running for the Republican nomination. So here's kind of how things break down. In the governor's race, in the Republican governor's race, John Husted came out on top, raising the most money during the cycle. Raised over $2 million, and that's in the last 3 months, Chuck. That's what the cycle is here. This isn't a six-month note. This is 3 months. And Mike DeWine, who's widely considered the front runner in the Republican Party for this seat because of his 95% name recognition, raised 1.2. So, wow, Houston's like, you know, showing strong, right? Well, not necessarily, because then you look at cash on hand, and DeWine has $4.67 million on hand to run his race. And Jim Renacci, the U.S. Congressman from the Wadsworth-Medina area, who only raised $576,000 in the cycle, loaned himself $4 million for the cycle.
Must be nice. Nice to have...
Jim Renacci owned car dealerships before the Obama administration, the bailout with General Motors. He was one of the dealers who GM agreed to basically pull their dealership from in order to assuage the federal government in order to qualify and to keep the bailout money. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what spurred him to run for Congress in the first place, was basically losing his dealership for no better reason than, well, because the president was handing out money to the company. So he had amassed quite a bit of wealth, and now he owns some other businesses, including I think he's a part owner of the A.D. Farrow chain of Harley Davidson dealerships.
Uh-huh, yeah. So he's doing
That doesn't like keep you in the poorhouse.
Nothing like selling $40,000 motorcycles to make a little money.
Yes, there's nothing like that. So that puts Jim Renacci actually with cash on hand right behind Mike DeWine. He has almost $4.4 million on hand, and Houston has $4.28 million. Now Mary Taylor, who actually raised a little bit more money in the cycle than Renacci did, once you discount him loaning himself $4 million, came in dead last with cash on hand, and honestly, Chuck, it's not even close. I mean, DeWine, Renacci, and Houston all have over $4 million cash on hand. Mary Taylor has $436,000. Folks, this is not looking good for there being a four-way primary coming into the filing deadline. I'm going to say that up front
Well, Barry, you always said you liked Mary Taylor. I can remember talking about Mary Taylor and you said, but she can't raise money.
She can't raise money, and you know, and of course some of her closest supporters would like get in my face about that, but I'm looking at them like, guys, it's there, it is, you know. And honestly, of that $436,000, I think at least four or five maxed out contributions, and of course Third Rail has that list, come from like her husband and her sons and, you know, close family members. Once you have tapped family and you subtract that out, you're looking at Mary Taylor didn't quite raise $400,000 during the entire cycle, while, you know, Houston was raising $2 million and DeWine and Renacci were both raising $1.2 million and $576,000 respectively. So, you know, of course, they all spin it, you know, and I laugh because as I'm watching these quotes coming across, you know, Houston's basically in here, and he's touting that he's got momentum and grassroots support, and that he was the only candidate who didn't put his own money in. So, okay, kudos to Houston for that. Now, DeWine's campaign spends it that DeWine's the most popular conservative leader. Now, and I want you to understand that wording.
Yeah.
Conservative leader.
In quotes.
It's a primary, folks. That's you're going to hear it until the primary is over with. And it'll be coming from all of them. You know, Jim Renacci's campaign. I'm in it to win in this race because I know that with a new brand of conservative leadership in Columbus.
New brand. Uh-oh.
New brand. Conservative. Okay, so they're just all here. Just, okay, that's enough said on that, but everybody's trying to spin this. Even Mary Taylor's trying to spin a $400,000 on hand as, I am all in and in it to win it. Today's campaign finance report tells me that Ohioans who want to see a candidate with vision, energy, ability, and who can win next November are in it with me. Yes, problem is, Mary, they're in it with their money for Houston, DeWine, and Renacci. That's where the money's going.
Yeah, they're in it with a big fat wallet for the other candidates, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think vision, energy, and ability is going to be able to buy you enough airtime in order to break Mike DeWine's 95% name ID. Let's just put it out there. And, of course, you've got a lot. You know, they give the list of the biggest donors to each of these people, and these are ones who basically maxed out for the cycle, $12,000-plus per person, okay? And you'll see some names in there. Some of them will look somewhat familiar. Some of them won't. Nothing really jumped out as quite, you know, over the top with any of these particular things. You know, you'll see like the CEOs of major companies. You know, I like the ones where like you get the civic volunteer as the designation for their employer or their occupation. Well, these are people who are either retired or they're family members are the CEOs, and so they're spending the money as a civic volunteer.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious. But, you know, you just go down through here, and it's just, again, if you know what you're looking for, you can see and you figure out who's lining up behind who with the way it works. Now, the big story was not the governor's race. The big story was a little run between two members of the State House of Representatives, both of whom are gunning to be the next Speaker of the House. One is Ryan Smith, my representative, the chair of the House Finance Committee from Gallia County, who raised a, well, fairly impressive $461,000 in the cycle. Now, this is pretty good for a country boy coming from Gallia County. Of course, he raises most of his money all over and outside of the state. And his primary key opponent for speaker is a former member who has now come back after setting out for a while and who's fairly well known by the name of Larry Householder from Perry County. Larry Householder also was the top money raiser in the entire House this last cycle. He raised over $715,000 as a House member for one cycle, for a three-month period, and has almost $700,000 cash on hand. Now, Smith's got $473,000 cash on hand, but Smith's numbers are a little deceiving because he also wrote a check for $400,000+ to a thing called OHROC, O-H-R-O-C. And people get familiar with that. That's the Ohio House Republican Operating Committee.
Yeah.
That is the political arm of the House Republican Caucus. That's where they bank the money and get the members to write big checks from their campaigns to OHROC, so then OHROC can control money out to run races where there's an open seat, or they're defending, or they're trying to pick up a seat, and they've got some, you know, first-time candidate that's running in this seat, and they're trying to bolster them with money. Now, don't forget, though, that the person who controls OHROC, the operating committee, is the Speaker of the House, who is Cliff Rosenberger. Interesting little thing with Cliff Rosenberger, two things. Number one, he happens to be close personal friends and roommates, while they're in Columbus together, with Ryan Smith. So if he's controlling OHROC and Ryan just handed him $490,000, do you think that maybe if it gets tight that the OHROC will start handing out money to candidates who have committed to back Smith for speaker? Of course, that's exactly what's going to happen. Larry Householder's getting money from everywhere, and he only gave $50,000 to OHROC because he knows the game, okay? He knows there's no sense of handing his money over to Speaker Rosenberger him then give it to Ryan Smith's candidates. That just doesn't make any sense.
Because I see committee to elect Cliff Rosenberger, two checks amounting to $460,000.
Yeah, well, that's right. Rosenberger basically put in $460,000 out of his campaigns into OHROC as well. And of course, if you're speaker, you're kind of expected to lead with that. Now, Householder is actually doing this thing where he's kind of been the former legislator coming back, and he knows the game because he was in control of the game at one time as speaker. He was the former Speaker of the House before when he was in office. He knows what's going on, so he's not giving OHROC a bunch of money. He's raising boatloads of money. Now, the big problem is right now, he did raise some money during this cycle from county parties. And as of yesterday, he was giving some of that money back. Actually, he's given most of that money. Not all of the 700 and some he raised, but he had received a check for $70,000 from the Summit County, that's the Akron area, Summit County Republican Party, and a $63,000 check from the Cuyahoga County, the Cleveland Republican Party, to Larry Householder for his run for speaker. Now, what happened was the current speaker, Rosenberger, put out a memo basically saying that it's a campaign finance by ethics violation for Householder to take those levels of donations from those county parties because they're not in counties that he represents as a legislator. Now, the county party chairman are saying, wait a minute, you know, he's running for Speaker of the House, and that's actually, you know, they kind of worked on, that was like a statewide sort of office like governor and everybody else is. And so therefore, if they're given to him for his speaker race, they're actually given like statewide candidates, and that opens up campaign finance limits on county parties. Otherwise, they can only give to a legislator who's not one of their own the same amount that an individual can max out, and that's about $12,700. So Householder, without you know being told to do so, he wrote checks back, at least the one to the Summit County, gave him $70,000 back. It's unclear right now if he's going to give the $63,000 back to Cuyahoga because the Cuyahoga County Republican Party chairman basically is like, no. You know, but Rosenberger is saying, oh, I got this from the Secretary of State's office, and they're saying this, and this is the thing, and so you can't do that. Still doesn't matter. Even taking that $33,000 out of householders' take, he still raised more money than anybody in the Republican caucus, and significantly more than his, you know, number one opponent for the speaker's chair, Ryan Smith. But again, with Ryan Smith probably having O'Rourke behind him, that's going to make it a little tougher, and so householders probably going to be much more creative. And let's not kid ourselves. Both of these parties will find individual donors who haven't maxed out yet to basically swing that back around and get it back into Larry Householder's campaign. That's the way things work.
Sure.
Matter of fact, now there's a question, and I know we're running late on time. Now there's a question of whether or not the state Republican Party might have been involved, because about 2 weeks prior to Summit County writing that, to Cuyahoga County writing that $63,000 check, they received a $63,000 donation from the state party.
Yeah, it's the old trick.
Yeah, well, just because those numbers are exact doesn't necessarily mean,
right?
Really. Yeah, okay. But point is, this story is getting legs. It's going to be very interesting. But ultimately, when it gets right down to it, the rumble around the state house is it's kind of a Hobson's choice. There are some members who are totally loyal to either one of these two individuals. And then there are some members who are looking at that like, okay, you're asking me if I want to take hemlock or strychnine.
No, thanks.
I think I may go see if we can find an option three out here somewhere and just have a nice, you know, nice alternative. That may still happen. I don't know. But there are rumblings around there that this thing might get more interesting than it seems. And that would be nice because, honestly, the statewide candidate issues are starting to look a little bit like a yawner. Unless, of course, before we get the filing deadline, you have a, shall we say, jumble up.
Yeah.
Possibly maybe two of the key front runners thinking that it would be stupid for them to waste money against each other might team up so that they have more money to go run against the Democrat who may be Rich Cordray coming back from the federal level.
Oh, my gosh.
That's a big thing. So they're going to need, if it's Rich Cordray as the Democratic nominee for governor, whoever comes out of the Republican primary is going to need a lot of money.
Yeah, well, apparently, you know,
Cordray can raise it.
Yeah, but if you can't make it in Ohio politics, you get yourself a federal sinecure, which was exactly what that position created especially for him by Obama. That was supposedly a non-political appointment, and then come back to Ohio and see if you can not get the job done again. That'll be interesting if that happens. It does kind of look like the dominoes do seem to be lining up, like they're trying to do an end around to make Cordray the big player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what the Democratic Party is trying to do is line up a Rich Cordray Nan Whaley ticket. However, that may be blocked a little bit as well, because I believe I can't remember if it was Istook or somebody in that Congress has now asked for a congressional investigation as to whether or not Rich Cordray has violated the Logan Act by being involved in campaigning for the governor's seat while he's a federal employee.
Oops,
yeah. Well, and don't think that it hasn't been generated from the Republican Party in Ohio, basically working through some channels to see Cordray get smeared before he can come back to Ohio.
They would be stupid if they didn't.
They'd be completely politically inept if they did.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, guess what?
We're out of time.
We are out of time. You know what we think, and we definitely want to know what you think. I've been checking because nobody ever comments on our shows. So I'm checking to see if the comments are turned off. Well, they're not. They are turned on. And you can get to them at www.principledpolicy.com. Now, we know you're out there listening because we can see people are downloading the podcasts. And we would very much like to hear from you. Leave us a comment. And the way you do it is you can't do it from the front page. You have to click on the actual podcast that you are click on the title, the one you're listening to. From the front page, and right there will be a thing that says leave a comment, and I'll give you the website again, www.principledpolicy.com. That being said, come out, listen, leave us a comment. We'd actually love to do a segment talking about comments that we've got. So, but we have to get them first. So leave a comment. That being the case, we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.